This is Pet Life Radio. Let's talk pets.
Hey there, cat lovers. Welcome to Nine Lives with Dr. Cat. I'm your host, Dr. Catherine Prim, and I'm a small animal veterinarian and crazy cat lover. Today, I have an exciting and fun guest with me, Catherine Hughes. She is a prize-winning author, and she has a new book called Catland. And I think that you're really going to like it. The New York Times describes it as a delight, and the Wall Street Journal says it is sparkling. So we're going to talk with Catherine and find out everything about her book and how she loves cats and how she loves history. So we'll be right back.
You know the expression, cats have nine lives. Well, what if you can give them one more? The Give Them 10 movement is on a mission to help give cats an extra life. How? With spay and neuter. Spaying or neutering your cat helps them live a longer, healthier life. And it helps control free-roaming cat populations, too. Learn more about the benefits of spay and neuter and meet Scooter, the neutered cat, at givethem10.org. That's givethem10.org.
Let's Talk Pets on PetLifeRadio.com.
Welcome back to Nine Lives with Dr. Cat on Pet Life Radio. I have Catherine Hughes with me today. Hi, Catherine.
Hi, Catherine. It's very nice to speak to somebody who spells their name the same way as me. It's quite rare. So I'm so glad to talk to another Catherine who spells her name with an R-Y-N at the end.
I think it was you that said there is no other way, right?
There is no other way. You are so right. Everybody else is just doing it wrong.
Exactly. So I really appreciate you taking the time to join me today. Can you kind of start with just telling a little bit about yourself and your journey in history and cats?
Yeah, of course. Well, I grew up in a really big cat loving family. My grandmother bred blue Persian cats. And my mother, who was an only child, grew up with something like 17 cat siblings. So I come from a very long line of absolute cat lovers. I'm also a university historian, which means I'm a professor of history at university. And this project was just the sort of the perfect combination of my two interests. I mean, it's a sort of wonderful thing for me to do. I love history, particularly Victorian history, so the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century. And I adore cats. I've actually got a cat sitting on my lap here. He's just coming. He likes to supervise all my broadcasts. So it was just a perfect project for me. And I was just really pleased to see that it hadn't really been done before, because, you know, that's something that as an historian you always worry about. You think, oh, somebody's surely written about the way in which cats became so fashionable in the 19th century. But when I looked in the library, I found it hadn't really been done. So it was just the perfect topic for me.
Well, so cats have a long history alongside human beings. And I know that you have looked into how this relationship began. So can we talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. Well, the difference, I think the big difference between cats and dogs is that dogs were domesticated, in other words, started living alongside humans about 40,000 years ago. I mean, people argue about the date. With cats, it's only about 12,000 years ago. So already you've got this very distinct kind of relationship. Dogs were there right from the start when we were hunter-gatherers, where we were sort of running across the plains to catch our dinner. Dogs were necessary to track down the prey, to follow it down burrows, to guard the cave. I mean, they were there right from the beginning. Cats are much later additions to the human household. They come along once early men and women start agriculture. So once men and women start staying in one place, they're not hunting and gathering, but they're growing crops. And that's where the cat really comes in. The cat becomes very useful as a sort of semi-detached freelance domestic worker. So cats are very useful for catching rodents, for keeping the hay barn completely free of, you know, nasty critters that will eat up your foodstuffs. They're very good at keeping the domestic hearth nice and clean, but they're not integrated in the same way. I mean, you don't have a guard cat, for instance, nor do you have a cat sort of, helping out hunting for dinner. It doesn't do that. So cats have always had this kind of independent relationship with humans. They're there, they're providing a service, but there's a sense in which if the terms of the engagement change, in other words, if the cat feels that it could find better terms of employment, it could go to next door's farm and find more nice things to eat, it will do that. And that, I think, tells us a lot about the different sort of relationships, really, that cats and dogs have with the human household. I mean, it's very interesting because early men and women bred dogs for specific tasks. So they bred sort of little, we call them dachshunds over here, sausage dogs. They go down burrows to flush out rabbits. And we bred big dogs, St. Bernards, to help pull people out of snow. And we bred big dogs to pull carts. None of that happened with cats. Cats were just left to get on with the project of reproducing themselves. And that's why cat breeds are such a recent thing. They didn't really start until the mid-Victorian period. Really, they exist still in a sort of state of nature. They're with us, but they're with us because they want to be here. I think that would be the best way to describe it.
Yeah, I like to say if a cat likes me, I feel like I've really done something because he or she doesn't really need me. They are choosing to be with me. So I think that's kind of the same thing.
Yeah, that is absolutely right. And that's why it's just such a privilege, as you say, when they do decide to live with you, because I always say it's like having a slightly kind of high maintenance boyfriend or in the sense that, you know, you're never quite sure of the relationship. He could be dating other people. And it's like that with a cat, you know, it's got options. It doesn't have to kind of please you in particular. And that's what I think makes it makes the cat so intriguing, as opposed to the dog, which is, I mean, over here, we always refer to the dog as being man's best friend. That sense in which the dog is always soldered to you. He's there. He's never going to leave you. You could introduce the most kind of appalling sort of circumstances and conditions, and he would still love you. And I think that's the difference between cats and dogs. It's that kind of really intriguing streak of independence that cats have.
I agree. Okay, so you have some interesting, famous cat fans, and some of these were surprises to me. So can you talk a little bit about some of the things you uncovered along the way of famous cat fans?
Well, I was really intrigued by Mark Twain, actually, because he was so cat crazy that when he went away on holiday, he would actually make sure that the house where he was going had cats for him to live alongside. If it didn't have that, he would hire cats locally to come and live with him. Say he took he rented a cottage, say, in the summer for 6 weeks. He would actually rent local cats to come and live with him, which I think is just quite extraordinary and struck everybody as completely eccentric, of course, at the time. Then we've got Florence Nightingale, very famous, one of our sort of really famous nurses, the first nurse. She lived with, I think she had 17 cats, and she lived in London. And she was absolutely, I mean, she treated them like people, and she called them after famous politicians. So she would call them Gladstone, that was the name of our prime minister at the time, or Disraeli, another prime minister. And she also talks in her letters to her friends about wanting to find them good husbands. So she's always trying to mate her cats with other pedigree animals. And her cats are actually just rather resistant to this because they're indoor and outdoor cats. So her cats like to go outside and mate with, you know, rather rough street cats. And Florence Nightingale is absolutely appalled by this. And she says that no matter how much she tries to find nice suitors for her cats, that they will always have their own way with the sort of neighborhood Toms. And she's very, very outraged by that. And then there's some really spooky sort of behaviors that I think we would find very strange. So Charles Dickens, the famous novelist, he was very fond of a cat called Bob, so much so that when Bob died, Dickens had Bob's front forepaw made into a sort of a handle for a letter opener. So if you can imagine, Bob's sort of the front bit of his paw was attached to a knife, and then Dickens used that every day to open his letters. And that really gruesome letter opener can be found, I think it's in the New York Library. And that, I think, strikes us as very odd, because while we love our cats, I think the idea of, after their death, of cutting bits off them and then incorporating them into household furniture would honestly strike us as completely unacceptable and quite macabre. So it's very, very interesting to see how attitudes have changed to what you do with your cat and how you commemorate them.
I agree. I would not make anything out of my cat's parts. So I find that a little odd. Now, there are some of the things that I've read aren't as odd, like the man who had his new house built on the same design as his old house so it wouldn't confuse his cat. And I mean, some of the things are a little more in line with what I might do, but you tell us some more.
Yeah, no, you're mentioning there Edward Lear, the famous poet who wrote a poem called The Owl and the Pussycat, which every English schoolchild knows. Owl and Pussycat went to sea in a beautiful pea green boat. Lear was an absolute cat man. He lived in the Italian Riviera, and he was so attached to his cat, who was called Foss, that when Lear decided that he had to move house, instead of just moving house, he had a villa built on exactly the same plan as his current house, so that Foss, who was getting quite elderly, wouldn't be confused about the layout of the rooms. And I think that's kind of completely charming, this idea that you would construct your house entirely to take account of the preferences of your aging cat. But I think that seemed so eccentric that's a story that has come down to us. So it tells you that actually most people didn't do that sort of thing. I think what I was very surprised to discover in the 19th century was still that the cat was regarded as not having a kind of incredibly high status. So people weren't necessarily cruel to cats, but the idea that you would lavish attention on them in quite the same way that we do today, or that Edward Lear did, that seems quite unusual, I think.
So, not very many people, like you said, Thomas Hardy carved gravestones. Not very many people did that back then.
That's true, actually. So Thomas Hardy, great, one of our great novelists, wrote Tess of the D'Urbervilles and Jude the Obscure. He was a devoted cat man. Unfortunately, he had really bad luck, because his house was very near to the railway. The railways had just come in. They were the big new thing. Unfortunately, the railway ran at the bottom of his garden, which meant his cats tended to come to grief on the railway line. And this absolutely undid him with grief. He was absolutely distraught about this. And what he would do, he would insist on carving gravestones for each of his cats in the garden. And although he was a great novelist, he was a working man. He had started actually as a stonemason, so he'd come from very humble beginnings, but he remembered those skills. And so even as an elderly man, he would use his old kind of stone marking tools to make these very elaborate graves for his cats in the garden. And that is actually a very sort of charming story, I think.
Yes, I think it's very charming. I think today we do a lot of those things, but back then it was really different. I want to take a quick break and come right back and talk about some surprising things and some creepy things that I learned from Catland, and I want you to give the taste of. So we'll be right back.
Molly, here's your dinner. Zeus, that's not your food.
Don't let that happen to your precious cat. Elevate your cat's eating experience with the Cat Tree Tray. The Cat Tree Tray keeps your cat's food off the floor and conveniently located on the cat tree. It's the perfect way to eat. It's a beautiful wrought iron tray that easily attaches to your cat tree and keeps dogs and other critters out of your cat's dish. A must for multi-pet households. There's a 6-inch tray for large bowls and a 4-inch tray for smaller bowls. Purchase your cat tree tray today. Go right now to cattreetray.com. That's cattreetray.com. cattreetray.com.
Let's talk pets.
Let's talk pets.
On Pet Life Radio.
Pet Life Radio.
PetLifeRadio.com.
Welcome back to Nine Lives with Dr. Cat on Pet Life Radio. So Catherine Hughes and I are talking about cats in history, interesting things that people did because they loved their cats, and surprising facts. So there are some interesting facts that have kind of come down through history where cats have played a role that I was surprised by. Can we talk about those?
Yeah. Which ones did you have in mind particularly?
I thought it was super interesting the role that cats played in fashion.
Yeah, that is absolutely extraordinary. I mean, again, there's some slightly creepy things. There was in the 1880s, one of the Vanderbilts held a very swish party in New York to celebrate having built a house that was bigger than anybody else's. And one of the guests actually arrived. It was a fancy dress ball. Arrived in a dress that was entirely made out of cat skins. And on her head, she had perched a whole kitten head that was sort of popped on front of, and on top of her head like a hat. I mean, this seems absolutely extraordinary. We would find this absolutely repulsive. But the newspapers took many, many photographs of her. It was in the New York Times. People thought it was a simply sort of charming thing to do. Again, I find that really, really strange. And the other thing that happened once people started driving in the new automobiles, which tended to be open to the elements, so therefore quite chilly, quite cold, there was, again, a feeling that cat skin was particularly good at making car coats. So very, very dense fur would be made into a coat that would then protect your chauffeur in particular from the driving wind that came with driving in an automobile. So that sort of thing, again, seems absolutely repugnant to us, I think.
But cats were kind of prestigious in Egypt and in times before. So I don't know, how did that devolve that way?
I think what happened, cats weren't worshipped in Egypt. That's a bit of a sort of misunderstanding, but they were, you're absolutely right, they were revered and they were treated with immense kind of honour. And what seems to happen is that, as in, it happens a lot in history, things change, different things happen, fashions go up and down. So what seems to have happened after the Egyptians is that cats then become farm servants, as I said before, they're helping out, keeping farmyards free from mice. And then what happens, I think in the beginning of the 19th century, is that people start looking at cats again in a new way and sort of honouring them, not just as kind of helpful kitchen pest controllers, but as much loved companion animals. And so what you find is you find families bringing their cats up from the kitchen and introducing them to the sitting room and the drawing room and giving them quite a sort of honoured place as a family member. And cats start to become the playfellow of middle-class children in particular. So there's an idea that a cat is a nice way, giving a child a cat to play with is a nice way, not just of honouring the cat, but is also teaching the child kindness, teaching the child cleanliness, because the Victorians were very, very keen on the fact that cats are very, very clean animals. And so there's this feeling that if you introduced your slightly untidy, messy children to a pet cat, they might pick up kind of some good habits of hygiene. There was something else that Victorians really, really admired cats for, and that was that cats are very, very good mothers. They look after their kittens really immaculately. They would, you know, do anything for their kittens. They really, really kind of make sure that they're well and they're fed. And again, actually, Victorian families liked that as a sort of model for how they would like their families, or how they would like to think that middle-class women would conduct themselves. So it's very interesting. The cat goes from being this slightly kind of raw-boned family kitchen servant, comes up to the drawing room or the sitting room, and becomes a sort of model of genteel behavior. It's very, very interesting. And on in the sort of along the way, the cat gets a new kind of identity. So when it's in the kitchen, it's possibly called Puss or Kitty or something very generic. Once the cat is introduced into the drawing room, it starts to have really quite grand names. So people start calling their cats things like, oh, Snowball or Princess, Princess Elvira, or something very sort of grand and slightly dainty. And that, I think, tells you something about the way that cats' status, as it were, changes. They become honored family members.
And then they influenced things like makeup, which I found very, very fascinating because people still do cat eye makeup now. But talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I found that so interesting. So it really so happens in the 1920s, so a little bit later. You're absolutely right. That's around the time that great discoveries are being made in the Valley of the Kings in Egypt, and the pharaohs' tombs are coming to light, and people are starting to see, because there's now photography, images of those extraordinary pictures of what Tutankhamun and the female the female members of the pharaoh family, what they look like. And what they have is that very distinctive cat eye, and which of course the Egyptians, they made that makeup out of sort of coal and water. But Helena Rubinstein, the cosmetics innovator around this time, introduces eyeliner to American women in particular, comes over to Britain and teaches them how to do, what we now call the cat flick, that sort of coal kind of line along the edge of your eyelashes, and then that little flick that makes you look like a cat, which is always very popular. I mean, it goes in and out of fashion. It was very popular in the 1960s, but it's very popular again now. And that was so interesting, I think, this idea that an idea of Egyptians and idea of Egyptians loving cats ends up with Helena Rubinstein making this particular kind of cosmetics that means that American women in the 1920s, again in the 1960s, and again now, can make that little sort of cat flick. I think it's absolutely fascinating.
Yes, it's on TikTok. I mean, it's really lasted the distance. Okay, so I know we're kind of running out of time, but you talked about a little bit of kind of the creepy things that people have done, but you've got specific cases of creepiness that involves cats. Can we talk about some of those?
Yeah, if it's not too upsetting, I'm very aware that some of this stuff sounds very, very strange. In Britain, there's long been a tradition of people stuffing animals to make sort of human pictures and images. And what we get in about the 1880s is a man called Walter Potter, who is stuffs kittens and then marshals them into kind of sort of all too human setting. So he makes something called the Kitten's Wedding, which is very famous, which shows lots of little stuffed kittens, and they're all dressed up in high Victorian fancy kit, and they're all there. It shows a bride and a bridegroom and a vicar, a priest, and a whole congregation, and it's both, I mean, charming and completely weird if you think about it for a bit too long. There was also a Philadelphian man, and he became very, very famous for stuffing kittens again, and then dressing them up in human gear and making them look as if they were living a sort of down home American dream. And I remember seeing those books as a child. My grandmother, who was a cat breeder, had some of them, and they really gave me the creeps. You can still see them now. You can certainly see them on Pinterest and things like that. So cat little kittens dressed up in gingham frocks, doing Americana things, making pies, greeting the postman, doing the washing, swinging on a swing, posting a letter. And again, people seem to have found this thing absolutely charming. I think we would find it very, very strange. I don't think we'd ever let a child see this now because it would give anybody nightmares.
Well, and it would be illegal.
It would be illegal. Yeah.
Okay, so what about some phrases that we have in the English language, like cat burglar? Where did that come from?
Oh, that's so interesting. So this was a man in the 1920s. We don't even quite know what his name was because he kept on changing it because he was that much of a criminal. Anyway, young man who made a name for himself as a very, very skilled burglar. So what he would do is he would climb up drain pipes when even when the families were inside sitting down to dinner, he would climb up their drain pipes, shimmy in through a bathroom window that had been left open, and then steal all the jewelries, all the jewelry that he could find, or any money. And this so baffled the police before they caught him that they referred to him as the cat burglar of Streatham. Because he seemed like a magic person. He arrived in the dark, in the night. You could never catch him. He was gone before anybody could find him. And actually, I think it was the Washington Post found this so interesting that they ran a story about the cat burglar of London town. And it took off in America. Obviously, not the same burglar. He was by now locked up safely in prison. But it sort of started a fashion for other burglars to do this thing of not going to the scene of the crime armed with heavy kind of hammers and mallets and baseball bats, but simply armed with your very lithe body and your nine, doing the deed, doing the bad deed before anybody had noticed what was going on. So it's a fascinating story.
Well, I agree, and I don't want to spoil all of the fascination of your book. I would love to hear what you hope that readers will take away from your book and maybe touch a little bit more on the premise of the actual book.
Well, the premise of the book is about the fact that cats, really for centuries, had been almost invisible, which is to say there were lots of them around. Every farmyard had them. Every basement kitchen had them, but nobody really noticed them. They were sort of part of the domestic furniture, as it were. And then what seems to happen in about the middle of the 19th century is that suddenly people start noticing these extraordinary creatures, which have been amongst them all this time, beautiful, clever, skilled, and fascinatingly independent, as we said. Always slightly semi-detached, always able, as it were, to move on if you know, they found something that liked them better. And what seems to happen is that this vision of the cat as a very modern creature, someone who can negotiate the new urban conditions, who thrives in the city, who always can find something to do, can find a way to survive, all that chimes very nicely with the way in which humans are also moving into the cities and finding new ways of living together, new ways of surviving, new kinds of jobs, new kinds of activities, and a sense that the world is speeding up, that there's cinema, there's automobiles, the world is suddenly becoming modern. And it is a world into which the cat fits very nicely, I think. And there was a very famous artist, both he's British, but he worked in New York for a while, called Louis Wain, who made some fabulous pictures of cats living a sort of modern urban life. So dressed up in clothes, going about a modern, rather kind of exciting, glamorous life, going to the theatre, meeting friends to play tennis, driving an automobile. And somehow Louis Wain managed to sort of put together this notion of the cat as a very kind of modern and slightly glamorous animal. And I was so intrigued by the way in which these things come together, that modern urban living comes together just at the point where people started to notice cats in a slightly different way. And I do think cats, if it's not too highfalutin to say this, cats sort of start to kind of be an agent of change. They start to make the world seem modern. And I was very, very excited in exploring that, but also in finding out all sorts of just extraordinary, interesting stories along the way.
I agree 100%. And I appreciate you taking the time to share your incredible thoughts and all the cool little snippets from your book. Let's talk about where my audience can find your book and learn more about you.
Oh, okay. Well, that's very kind of you to ask. Now, the book in America, it's called Catland. And of course, you can get it in all good bookstores or Amazon, should you want to go there. I've got a website, which is katherinehughes.co.uk. And Catherine, as we've already discussed, is spelled KatherineHughes.co.uk. And I think the links there will point you to the book. It's very easily available. And you can also read on the website just a bit more about me and my work and the kinds of historical topics that I'm interested in.
So the book is a really, really easy read. I encourage all of my listeners to check it out because you will learn something interesting about cats. So thanks again for your time today. And also, I would like to thank my producer, Mark Winter, because he makes it all happen. And I would like for all of my listeners to go out and have a perfect day.
Let's Talk Pets, every week on demand, only on PetLifeRadio.com.